Stai ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.
Hello there and welcome to Short Science, your 80s themed portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
And I'm Emma Berger. Coming up on today's show, the latest science and health stories in news in brief. I'll be looking at the concept of using animals in scientific investigation in capsule science, and in capsule medicine, Elizabeth will be looking at the use of animals to develop new treatments.
Plus, in our guest slot this week, we'll again be hearing from Flaminia Catarucha and her team about her work on mosquito reproduction.
All that will be coming up on today's show, along with our brand new quiz and some more science trivia for you to fathom out at home.
This is Short Science.
So, continuing last week's fascinating insights into mosquito research, we will be rejoining Flaminia and her team to hear more about their discovery.
And in today's show, we'll be considering the use or abuse of animals in the name of science and medicine.
Now, frequent listeners will know all about our fantastic website. The address is www.shortscience.co.uk. If you've never checked it out, it's worth a look, if only for the fabulous 80s stylings.
But stylings aside, there's also a lot of useful information to be found there. Now, you can find out what's coming up on the show, listen again to a show you might have missed or really enjoyed, and you can subscribe to the podcast or listen online via our handy podcast page.
Plus, you can send in your profile for everyone to take a look at and even have your very own capsule science to tell people about your science.
Now, we're really interested in what you think about science or indeed about short science. So send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk for a mention on the show, or if there's some burning question you'd like us to answer, then drop us a line. Now, you can also request a capsule science or medicine topic or volunteer to be a guest on the show.
Now, before we get going with the show, it's time to flag up a science event for this week.
Yep, so this was an email I got from Ivy, and she wants me to tell you about a competition. So this is the We Are Science photographic competition being run here at Imperial College by the Society of Women in Science, Engineering and Technology and the Photographic Society. Now, what you need to do to enter is take a photograph representing the theme of women in science. Now, this can be as creative as you like. All entries must be received by the 19th of February, and there are three great prizes to be won.
All the details, including how to submit your photos, will be available on our website events page at www.shortscience.co.uk/science-events, all one word. But this competition is only open to individuals from Imperial College.
That's right. We must stress that you must be a member of Imperial College in order to enter the competition, but we thought that was a bit of a shame. So if you're not from Imperial College, then please send along your photo to us at Short Science and we will put them up in a mini gallery on our website for everyone to see. And if you send us in a photograph, you'll get a fantastic Short Science magnet. Now it's time for this week's Science News in Brief.
Iran launches animals into space.
Simple headache pill could save earthquake victims.
Spidey material could be smart material.
And drink to your bone health with beer.
Firstly today, the news that Iran has reportedly launched an experimental capsule into space containing a variety of animals.
A variety of animals. Which animals are they then?
Apparently a rodent, non-specific, two turtles and several worms. The rocket is named Kavoshgar 3 and is part of the Iranian space program.
I didn't even know there was an Iranian space program.
Well, over the last few years, it seems that several of the growing Asian economies have been making enormous technological progress and have entered an era of the Asian space race to rival the previous Cold War space race between the US and the Soviet Union.
Well, I guess previously, if we ever heard about projects in space, they were usually based in the USA or Russia.
Indeed, but in the near future, we are to expect major developments in space from China, Japan, India, Iran, and other major Asian nations.
Something to keep an eye on then. Well, the first health story today is the news that a single paracetamol or Tylenol tablet could help save victims of the earthquake in Haiti.
How would that work?
Well, victims who are crushed can suffer a condition called rhabdomyolysis. Now, when the pressure or weight of rubble is lifted from the body, debris from damaged muscles floods into the bloodstream and can fatally damage the kidneys. Now, experiments have shown that a single dose of paracetamol can prevent this from happening. Now, it's hoped that this finding can be validated before the next big earthquake so that it can be used to prevent crush syndrome, taking many needless lives.
Well, let's hope so. So my next story is all about spiders and how their webs could help lead to the development of new materials.
So what's so special about spider webs?
Well, the silk of the spider webs catches water droplets when the air is damp, and this affects the structure of the fibrils that make up the silk. Now, the changing nature of the silk drives the water to the edges of the silk fibres and the knots in the web, where the water all gathers into large droplets.
But how does the silk change?
Well, each length of spider silk is made up of multiple joints connected by many tiny, tiny nanofibrils, kind of like small beads on a multi-string necklace. However, in the presence of water, the nanofibrils clump together to make the entire length of the silk smooth and straight.
But how could that help us then?
Well, there's no man-made material that can act in this way. Now, if they can mimic this behaviour, they could develop materials that gather and collect substances in the same way. This could be used in chemical reactions when they wish to take specific chemicals out of the reaction.
What fascinating stuff. Now, finally today, news that a beer a day could keep brittle bones at bay.
How's that then?
Well, beer is rich in silicon, and this has been strongly linked to bone health. Now, silicon actually helps bones to grow, and that's vital for the renewal process that's ongoing to maintain bone strength and health.
So is this any old beer, or are some better than others?
Well, there's a huge variation in silicon levels in beer, from 6.4 to 56 milligrams per litre. And it's the palest ales, made from pale malted barley husks and hops, that have the highest levels of silicon.
Well, I'll be on the lookout for those paler ales then.
Indeed. Now, any comments or questions about any of our news this morning, you know what to do. Send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time for Capsule Science. Now, animal testing is often important in medical research and understanding health and disease. However, animals are used for other studies. So, Emma, why would we do non-medical research on animals?
Well, testing on animals for medical purposes is usually applied research, where a specific medical problem is investigated in an animal model. However, pure research is often also carried out on animals, which aims to further our understanding of how living things develop, function, and behave.
Now, obviously, animal testing is a pretty controversial subject in general, but do you think that pure research might cause slightly more controversy, considering it's not trying to solve a medical problem that could potentially save lives?
Well, I agree that research that seems less necessary, that might cause undue harm or distress to an animal, will probably cause more outrage than something that will probably help develop a treatment or cure for diseases that cause humans huge amounts of pain and distress. However, pure research is carried out in order to better understand evolution, genetics, psychology, and life in general, and the argument goes that this understanding can lead to unforeseen benefits and discoveries.
But there's quite a wide variety of animal research, and therefore a difference in how harmful it can be, right?
Well, of course, and research involving animals, especially non-medical research, can be as simple as observing animals in their natural habitat or in humane conditions in captivity. It can then move up to keeping them enclosed or hungry, perhaps causing distress so that they respond in certain ways, applying irritants to their skin in cosmetics tests, genetically modifying them or physically altering them. However, regardless of the extent to which the animals are interfered with, there have been cases of inhumane and cruel treatment in captivity, and also cases of researchers that take every precaution to ensure the animal experiences as little distress as possible, even when the research requires invasive procedures.
Okay, so let's have some examples of non-medical animal research then.
Well, one of the absolute standout cases of study on behavioural research in animals is the case of Pavlov's dogs.
Okay, so remind us about that then.
Well, Ivan Pavlov first described something called classical conditioning. He provided a stimulus, known as a conditioned stimulus, which was the ring of a bell or the tick of a metronome, depending on which source you believe. He then followed this up with food. Now, on receiving the food, the dog salivated, as they do in nature, and this is the unconditioned response. However, after a while, on hearing the conditioned stimulus, the bell, the dogs would salivate, regardless of whether there was food present or not, and that was a conditioned response. Now, this has been used in human situations since. For instance, in aversion therapy, where someone's conditioned to associate something with a negative feeling, and versions of it have also been used in military situations.
Okay, so what else have animals been used for then?
Well, there's also space. The first animals in space were fruit flies, followed by a rhesus monkey, Albert II. Mice and dogs were then sent into space until Laika, a mongrel stray, became the first animal to orbit the Earth. Now, these experiments were designed to test if living things could withstand spaceflight and going into orbit, and many of them did die on their missions for various reasons. But when animals started to return alive and well, it paved the way for humans to explore space.
Okay, so far we've talked about dogs, fruit flies, mice and monkeys. What animals are most commonly used in research and what for?
Well, in terms of numbers, the largest amount of animal research that goes on is on invertebrates, such as fruit flies and worms. Now, this type of research is mainly focused on development and on genetic studies due to their short life cycle and ease of genetic manipulation. Rodents are also often used in genetic studies now, as their genomes are actually very similar to human genomes. However, rodents are also often used in behavioural studies. Non-human primates, i.e. monkeys, are obviously the closest animal model to humans, and therefore they're good models for sociological, neurological and behavioural studies.
What about probably the most controversial issue in animal testing, cosmetics?
Well, for cosmetics testing, the most common test is the Dreyer's test, where the substance is applied to the test subject's eye or skin and left for a period of hours to observe any adverse reaction. Now, the test subjects are mostly albino rabbits because their tear ducts don't work in quite the same way as ours do. Now, this is a controversial subject, as cosmetic production is an unnecessary motive for causing harm to animals. In addition, the testing on albino rabbits has been criticised because of the differences from humans, meaning the test may not be even fully scientific.
Well, I'm going to have to stop you there, but that was very interesting. Now, if you have any questions about anything Emma has been telling us, or if you would like to suggest a capsule science topic for another week, then please get your laptop open, your typing fingers poised, and send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now, this week, we're going to hear more from Flaminia Cattaruccia and her team about their work on mosquito reproduction here at Imperial College.
Now, I'm very lucky because I'm not just here with Flaminia today. I'm actually here with the whole team. So, Flaminia, introduce me and tell me what everyone's been doing.
We are here with Dave Rogers, who's a postdoc in my group, and with Francesco Baldini, who's a PhD student. And they've both been working on mosquito reproduction. So Dave is mainly looking at the female side of mosquito reproduction, trying to understand what are the female factors that are important for triggering refractoriness to mating after first successful copulation, while Francesco has been mainly focusing on the analysis of male factors that are transferred to females during mating that can be important for influencing the female behaviour.
Okay, so Dave, let's come to you first, because you've been working on the female, and it's the female that does most of the damage, so let's start there. What have you been doing specifically, and what have you found out?
Well, this study in particular mostly focuses on something called a mating plug, which is a big gelatinous mass that's transferred from the male to the female during mating, and it's digested in the female reproductive tract during the first 24 hours after mating. And really, we just started off with the question of what is that mating plug composed of? And so our colleagues in chemistry, in Howard Morris's group, did some initial work just identifying the proteins that make up that mating plug. And that was really valuable because then it allowed us to start to tell a story about what was in the mating plug and what the mating plug does. And so as Flaminia mentioned, the first molecule we found, really, that was present at very high levels was filled with a particular amino acid called glutamine. And that suddenly made alarm bells go off, sort of, because it was really reminiscent of what happens in humans. And seminal coagulation in humans and how mammals make mating plugs use a glutamine-rich protein and an enzyme called the transglutaminase, which really links all the proteins together and almost makes a glue. And from that, we thought maybe that's how mosquitoes can make a mating plug. And so we did some biochemical work to prove that. And then we were very lucky when Francesco came in and started looking at RNAi techniques to manipulate the levels of that enzyme to see if we could prevent mosquitoes from transferring a mating plug or not.
Okay, that sounds like a good moment to bring in Francesco. So tell us a bit about how you've added to this.
As David was mentioning, we perform an RNA interfering approach in vivo. So this technique allows to manipulate the expression of genes, and then, of course, you will have a decrease of a specific protein. So we were able to decrease the protein level of this specific enzyme, which we thought was involved in this semen coagulation, and we actually demonstrated that in vivo, the males require this enzyme to produce the mating plug and so to transfer in the female. And once we were able to manipulate this in vivo, we looked at the female reproductive tract and we were very excited to see that not only the mating plug transfer was impaired, but also the sperm transfer inside the female storage organ was impaired, as the male was capable to transferring the sperm inside the spermatheca, but then probably a backflow from the spermatheca happened in the absence of the mating plug.
Now, thinking that I'd got away without seeing a single one of these little flying insects, the team have actually brought me up here to the top floor of the insectary here in the Alexander Fleming building, and we've gone through some rather official-looking airlocks and into a room full of little net-covered trays that are just swarming with mosquitoes. So for those of you who don't like mosquitoes, this is probably not somewhere you should come, but it is fascinating all the same. Now, it is quite noisy in here with the little sounds of all these mosquitoes, so let's see if we can get the microphone up nice and close and have a listen to what they're doing in their little cages. Well, it is really hot in here, obviously nice conditions for the mosquitoes to breed, but I'm quite glad that it's now time to leave and go back downstairs to the lab to find out a little bit more about the work the team have been doing. Flaminio, what are the implications for this finding in preventing malaria and attacking mosquito reproduction worldwide?
It's difficult to predict. However, what we can say is that for the first time we have managed to manipulate a male enzyme and found that this manipulation strongly affects female fertility, which is something that had not been done before. Now what we want to try and do is to translate these findings into possible tools for locking mosquito reproduction in the field. We believe that in the near future we could try to develop some inhibitors of these enzymes that could be delivered in a more high-throughput manner. Like in our laboratory, we inject males one by one in order to manipulate the function of this enzyme, which of course is not a viable option for the field, but we could in principle envisage to develop inhibitors of these enzymes that could be delivered the way maybe insecticides are normally delivered to field mosquitoes, either at the larval or at the adult stage, that could block the function of these enzymes or prevent the formation of mating plug in males and therefore prevent the storage of sperm in the females that these males mate with. We believe it's a very promising area of research. We're also performing further studies in the laboratory to try and identify novel targets for controlling reproduction and also to develop other innovative ideas and concepts for field applications. The challenge is how to bring this from the laboratory to the field and try to translate our knowledge into concrete, practical tools for the control of vector populations.
Flaminio, David and Francesco, thank you very much for talking to me today here in the Mosquito Lab. Flaminio Casaruccia, David Rogers and Francesco Baldini here at Imperial College. Now it's time for Capsule Medicine.
So, today Elizabeth is going to be looking at the use of animals in medical research.
Yeah, so when it comes to experimentation on animals, this is a very emotive and controversial subject, and I don't want necessarily to make any judgments on this today, but perhaps we could consider different contexts where animals are used and then look at some alternatives to animal testing. So maybe the first instance we should consider is the work we've been hearing about, studying mosquitoes to understand more about the disease malaria.
Well, seeing as we catch malaria from mosquitoes, it would be pretty hard to study malaria without studying the mosquitoes.
Exactly. Now, studying and experimenting on animals or insects that cause disease in humans might be an important approach to managing diseases like malaria. It would be an incomplete and limited approach that didn't take account of the role of the vector or infecting animal, and in looking for ways to prevent the disease, looking at the animal is an important first step. But this type of work could take things a step further still. The aim might be to genetically modify, for example, a mosquito so that it can no longer carry the malarial parasite. Then this modified mosquito might be released into the wild to take over from the native species, and it might cause extinction of a whole species of insect. But it might save millions of lives.
Okay, so we've talked about animals or creatures that cause disease. What's next?
Well, the next type of animal research is only subtly different, and this is the study of diseases that have originated in animals and a modified form has now affected or infected humans.
Like HIV?
Exactly. Now, simian immunodeficiency virus is believed to be the origin of the human immunodeficiency virus, or HIV. So studying SIV in monkeys may help us to understand more about HIV in humans.
Important research and drug testing can be carried out on these animals that could further our understanding of this devastating disease. And I suppose it could help us to treat the infected monkeys too. Now, another example of this might be the study of scrapie in sheep and bovine encephalopathy in cows to try and understand about spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease in humans.
Well, so far this has all been about the animal's role in passing on disease, either as a vector or as a victim of an intermediate disease form. So what about testing drugs on animals?
Well, then you start to get into a totally different area. Now you're talking about using animals as human substitutes to test drugs, for example, for toxicity levels, like how much of a drug you can give to somebody before their heart stops beating. Now, this is work that could equally be carried out on humans if we weren't squeamish about killing large numbers of people in order to get experimental data. Now, we obviously place less value on an animal life, and therefore we seem to be able to use them somewhat morally cheaply to conduct research.
And as an extension of that, what about when we cause disease in animals to then test treatments?
Well, a lot of drug trials work like this. As well as testing for simple parameters like toxicity, researchers in the first instance need to assess whether the potential drug has the desired effect on the disease. Now, if you were looking, for example, at a drug for breast cancer, it would not be practical to try to find animals with pre-existing breast cancer. And the disease may not even be naturally occurring in animals, so it's created experimentally in order to try to treat it experimentally. So, on the one hand, this seems doubly cruel. You're not only using the animal to test the drug, but you're creating a disease in that animal that it wouldn't otherwise have suffered. But on the other hand, it adds value to the contribution of the work on that animal, that the disease is as similar as possible to the disease in humans, so that the results mean as much as possible.
And presumably most of these animals either die from the results of the disease or the treatment, or they're euthanized for examination after the experiment.
In the vast majority of cases, yes. Now, occasionally research is carried out using animals that can then be rehomed or homed after the experiments are completed. Now, this would be more the case in purely observational experiments where researchers were observing behavioural or other features of the animal.
So, what are the alternatives?
Well, increasingly, researchers are able to grow human cells which they can work on. Now, they can also grow cancer cells or diseased cells with which to test various treatments. But ultimately, researchers need to know the effects of the drugs not only on the individual target tissue, but on the body as a complex system of organs. And the first round testing is not considered appropriate or safe enough to conduct in humans for the most part. So even when experimental cell models are available in the lab, animals are still needed for some parts of the safety testing.
So that's using human cells, but what about using computers?
Well, you can simulate complex systems with computers to a certain extent, but even drugs tested via these methods need to be tested on animals as well in order to become licensed drugs. But perhaps the role of these computer models is not so much to replace the animal testing, but to reduce the amount of animal experimentation needed by allowing it to be more targeted. The more information you have in advance, the less unnecessary work will be carried out.
Well, this is fascinating, but I'm going to have to stop you there. Now, if you have any questions or comments about this week's Capsule Medicine, please chuck an email our way at studio@shortscience.co.uk and we will do our best to answer your questions.
Now, we are continuing our 2010 quiz from last week. So Emma has retaken the lead with 9 out of 12, while I'm following close behind on 8 out of 12. So I'm going to go first with my first question for Emma. Question number one. The Centre for Alternatives to Animal Testing, or CAT, is based at which American university? Is it A, MIT, B, Johns Hopkins, or C, Harvard?
Right, well, they're all... don't know.
Come on, your extensive knowledge of American universities.
Well, MIT is in Massachusetts. Harvard is also in Massachusetts, I know that much. And obviously Harvard is a very prestigious university, as is MIT, like for technological things, right? Because it's a technology university. I don't know what Johns Hopkins
is. It really does sound to me like you're swimming in circles here, Emma.
Yeah, I am definitely swimming in circles. I'm thinking, because MIT is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that the whole animal testing thing is vaguely technological. So by that perhaps flawed logic, I will go for A, MIT.
And the answer is B, Johns Hopkins.
Oh, well, there you go.
So that's 0 for 1 for Emma so far, but never mind.
Right, so here we go with my first question. Right, common fruit flies are used extensively in animal-based research, but what is the binomial name for the fruit fly? Is it A, Caenorhabditis elegans, B, Drosophila melanogaster, or C, Danio rario?
Now, one of those I haven't heard of, and the other two I know what they are. So, Daniel Rerio I have never heard of, and I don't know, it could be anything really. It could be a giraffe for all I know. Canarorhabditis elegans, otherwise known as C. elegans, for those of us with pronunciation difficulties, is a worm, so yes, it's not indeed. That one. And Drosophila is, of course, the fruit fly, so I'm going to go for B. Drosophila melanogaster.
And indeed, you are correct. They are used extensively in labs, Drosophila melanogaster. Yeah, and C. elegans is the nematode worm, as you said. And Dania rerio is the zebrafish, which is also actually used quite a lot.
Not that far from a giraffe.
Giraffe, yeah. Giraffe, zebra, zebrafish.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is also used quite a lot in genetics kind of research. So there you go.
I'm obviously inspired today.
There we go. Right, question two for me.
Okay, question two for Emma. The three R's, which are the guiding principles for the use of animals in research, are replacement, which means using an alternative to an animal, reduction, which means using less animals for as much data as possible, and then what for the third R? Is it A, refinement, B, restriction, or C, respect?
Now, I don't want to, you know, get out there with this, but I think I know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is refinement, because it's about creating as little harm or distress to the animal as possible when you're testing it. So I think it is A, refinement.
Absolutely. So making it as humane as possible, minimising pain, minimising discomfort, and the time kept in captivity. So good. So you're now okay. One for two.
Got one.
So my second question, if you please.
It is. We talked about classical conditioning, Pavlov's dogs, and that is to condition response in association with a stimulus. But animals can also be conditioned in their voluntary responses when they know that by doing something, they will be either rewarded or punished. Now, what is this known as? It's sort of the opposite, or the counter thing. I don't know, the companion to classical conditioning. Is it A, post-event conditioning, B, emotional conditioning, or C, operant conditioning?
Okay, so with Pavlov, you ring a bell,
yep.
Then you give the dog some food.
Yeah.
And so the conditioned bit comes before the sort of the main bit.
Yeah.
And now what you're doing is you're saying you want somebody to do something, and every time they happen to do it, you're either going to punish them or reward them.
Yeah, so like if a monkey presses a button, then when they press the button, they get some food. So then they know if they press the button, they'll get the food. So then they do that every time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are two kinds of conditioning that everybody learns about. One is classical and the other is operant. So I would have to say that the answer is operant.
You are indeed correct.
I'm having a good day today.
You're having a good day. Two out of two.
I know, it's unheard of. Okay, so what were you on again?
One out of two.
One out of two, okay. So question number three for Emma. What was the name of the first computer-operated mannequin or crash test dummy, which was used as an alternative to animal testing? So this is like a computer model that simulates human biological responses. Was it called A, Ventura Vic, B, Almeida Al, or C, Sierra Sam?
Well, this I do not know, so this is going to be a guess, or perhaps, you know, educated guess, or not educated, as the case may be.
In fact, you're just going to make it up.
Yes. Ventura Vic, that sounds quite kind of computery, I think.
Futuristic.
Yeah, futuristic Ventura. Sierra Sam. Sierra is like the police alphabet, or whatever it is for S. It's sort of alliteration, I don't know. And Alameda Al. No idea.
I'll give you a little clue.
Yeah.
In that Ventura, Alameda, and Sierra are in fact all counties in the state of California.
Oh, well, there you go. That I didn't know.
There you go. So you learn something every time you listen to this show.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Absolutely. So, it's just a case of which one I'm going to go
help?
For.
Did that help? That little really. Gem of information? No. Okay.
County in California. Brilliant. Don't know which it was the crash test dummy was named after. So let's go for Ventura Vic, because that leaped out at me.
No, it's Sierra Sam.
There you go.
And actually, although they all happen to be counties in California,
yes,
it's named because the company that developed it was called like Sierra Systems or something like that.
Oh.
But I decided to go the Californian counties route, yeah, to fox you. And I succeeded.
And fox me you did.
Yeah. So there we go.
So that's one out of three. Poor okay. week for me.
I'm on two out of two and I need my third one, so come on, what is it?
Right, question three. Which mammals were the first to be sent into orbit in space and return safely? Is it A, monkeys, B, dogs, or C, humans?
Well, now, you said that the first animal to orbit was that dog called Laika or something.
Yeah, but she didn't come back safely. She died.
That's very sad.
Yeah.
I feel quite moved by that. You didn't mention that earlier. I was imagining like a little dog came back and went off to play with Jim and Sally in the garden. And
she was sent into orbit, but then apparently she overheated.
Bury her bone in the sandpit and she didn't get to.
No.
She burnt her crisp.
And she was a stray that they found on the street as well. They sort of found her on the street and bunged her in.
Well, how did they know that she didn't have some kind of overheating capacity?
I don't know. I think they tested her before.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel really sad.
I know.
So the dog they sent up that did orbit died.
Yes.
Maybe they sent another dog straight afterwards that lived. And then they thought, aha, now we'll send a monkey. And then when that came back, they thought, aha, now we'll send a person. So, dog... I'm going to go with dog, because I think after burning one, they wouldn't just then send a monkey. I think they'd send another dog until they got it right.
Okay. Yes, that is correct.
Oh,
they sent a pair of dogs into orbit, which came back safely, and it was the Russians. And apparently, the first puppy of one of the dogs, which was born and bred after the space mission, they gave as a present to Jackie Kennedy.
Okay.
In the spirit of goodwill, I guess. And apparently she's got countless descendants everywhere.
But, you know, like when they bring things back from space, like moon dust and stuff, they're like really paranoid that it's going to like kill the planets and infect everyone. So you'd think that the first dog that came back, they'd have been like, ooh, and put it in a like lead-lined box or something, just in case.
Maybe. But apparently they just bred it and gave away the puppies.
Yeah, so a little lack of care there, I think. Now, anybody who regularly listens to the show will know how unusual it is for me to actually get any questions right, let alone three.
Awesome.
So I think we should crack open the champagne, have a celebration. So my score has now moved on to 11 out of 15. And Emma, how many did you get right?
I definitely got one.
I forgot.
I think it was only one.
Our memory is so good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was just one.
I caught up in the excitement of the quiz.
11 out of 15 for me and 10 out of 15 for Emma. I have actually overtaken her, which is like the first time in the history of Short Science I've been in the lead on the quiz.
Over me or Georgia, in fact.
This is a momentous moment in history for me. Okay, so next week we will pick up this battle again when I will probably be put back in my place. But for now, it's time to answer the question, last week's science trivia question, which was...
Which bird was first domesticated by man?
And the answer was, somewhat surprisingly, the goose.
That is surprising, the goose.
I don't know why it's surprising.
I would have thought a chicken or something, but I guess geese are similar. Or a budgie. Perhaps.
I don't know. Anyway, so well done to anyone that did, in fact, know it was the goose. Now, the new question for this week is...
Dun, dun, dun. It is, what important medicinal agent was discovered by Friedrich Sir Turner?
Okay, so if you know the answer to that question, please drop us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Well, that's about all we've got time for on the show today. But before we sign off, if you've got any comments or questions, don't forget to email us to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now, you can send your suggestions for Capsule Medicine and Science, and let us know if you'd like to be a guest on the show. You can also submit your profile if you'd like to be added to our website and have your very own capsule there for everyone to take a look at. So what we really want to know is what it's like for you to be working in science and what it is that's important or interesting about your science.
Yeah, so the website is www.shortscience.co.uk. You can also listen again to the show from the Imperial College Radio website at www.icradio.com. And tomorrow the podcast will be out and available for download. You can subscribe to us via iTunes, just search for Short Science, or follow the link from our website. And alternatively, you can subscribe with any number of podcatchers by following the subscribe link on our podcast page.
So thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Our guests today were Flaminia Cattaruccia, David Rogers and Francesco Baldini. The presenters were Emma Berger and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves. The theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design.
Thank you very much for listening, and we will be back at the same time next week for another episode of Short Science.
Ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.